Okay, right. So it definitely a shorter parsha. It's still a very interesting one because we have kind of the final moments of Moshe's life, the final moments of his farewell speech. And the piece that I wanted to look at from Ksav Kabbalah this week comes kind of at the very end of the new bris that we enter into with Hashem. And he starts off the piece by quoting Rabbeinu Bachya. He doesn't quote kind of the classic ideas in Rashi or Ramban. He goes straight to Rabbeinu Bachya, who says as follows in Source 1. V'shmati b'shem Rambam zal, the perush pasuk zeh. I heard in the name of the Rambam, which in the footnotes in the Chevelle version, I think he says that there was some sort of commentary that the Rambam wrote or started writing on the Torah that I don't think we have nowadays, but that's what he's quoting from. He says, Anistaros l'Hashem Elokeinu, Yomar, this means to say, Sodos HaTorah Anistarim, the secret, hidden secrets of the Torah, V'tama Mitzvos l'Hashem Yisaleihem. And the rationale behind Mitzvos is to Hashem, meaning that's, it's beyond our understanding. It's in his hands. V'miskei Adam Shikach Azno Shemetz Minehem, V'yadiyas Shorash Mitzvah V'ikara B'Nistar Shiva, Al Yifater B'chach Min HaNigla Shelo Yasei Mitzvah B'Inyan Gufani. That is to say that if somehow we merit to understand a little bit a Shemetz Minehem, from the shorish, from the roots, or the basic principle of that hidden part of the mitzvah, the very fact that we've attained that knowledge does not exempt us from performing the mitzvah itself, the nigla. And if I somehow understand the inner meaning of tefillin, that doesn't change the fact that I have to put on tefillin, or whatever the mitzvah is. Ein lo limana mizeh, you can't just not do the mitzvah. Try niglos lano ulevineinu lasos, that which is explicit and clear in the Torah, it's on us and our in subsequent generations to do. It's a gem. It's a beautiful idea that the Rambam has. However, it doesn't have anything to do with what came before it. I shouldn't say it doesn't have anything to do with it, but it's not really in line with everything. Because obviously we have everyone gathering around. Hashem tells us, "Lavracha b'bris." Moshe tells us, "Lavracha b'bris Hashem elokecha va'alaso asher Hashem elokecha koris imcha hayom." And then goes on to describe the issue of avodah zarah and not straying toward avodah zarah. And then this is the very last pasuk of this parak. Where we say, "Anistaros Hashem Elokeinu va'niglos lanu levenenu ad olam lasos," is called Divrei HaTorah Zos. So we say, it doesn't really, what the Rambam says, it doesn't truly fit in. Which, you could argue that maybe it does. Because at the end of the day, there is the idea here in Pasuk. In Yudchas, Vahe b'shamo es divrei ha'ala azos v'is bareich b'levavo le'mor shalom yehudi ki b'shrius libi eilech. Maybe you could tie it into that, that people will just think I can go on whichever path I think is correct for me. Right, I think it's a little tenuous, but theoretically, maybe that's what the connection was. And then the Ksav Kabbalah continues on and quotes the Ralbag. One may think that failing to understand the mitzvot and their hidden rationale is itself a sin, that we have to strive, and that really part of fulfilling the mitzvah is understanding it completely. And by not understanding it, that's a chait. Our verse comes to teach us otherwise, that that's not at all true. Additionally, this verse teaches us that it is incorrect for a person to think, since the point of mitzvah X is to bring us to level Y, or etc., or to distance us from Y, I've achieved this on my own, and it doesn't matter if I ignore this mitzvah. And I thought the Rambam was taking it a little bit further, that the Rambam was saying that really predicated on our knowledge, that if I understand it, and maybe that will lead to action, that I'll be able to attain that level without actually fulfilling the mitzvah. The Rabbah makes it certainly more explicit that there is a certain level of kedusha, of closeness to Hashem that the mitzvah is meant to bring us to. And I did that on my own. I just happened to be, you know, it's supposed to make me compassionate. I happen to be a compassionate person. Or what the ideas that we see about Pasuk B'chalav and not eating birds of prey, about it being compassion and not being a cruel person. Things like that. Well, what happens if you're just not a cruel person to begin with? Does that mean you don't have to do the mitzvah? And he's saying, of course, that's not what it means. The point being, the Rabbah understands it essentially in the same way that the Rambam does. And at the end of quoting those, Safi Kabbalah says these are both very forced explanations. They don't really fit in.
It's a nice idea. It's something that probably should be discussed, but the question is the context of the pasuk. Is it really pshat?
Right. So he and obviously Rabbeinu Bachya as well say, yeah, it's beautiful, but no, it's not at all.
Pshat. You can
right.
learn that out, but not
right.
if you're trying to learn pshat.
So that's question one that we'll see here is what is pshat then in the pasuk? And then just to take a step back, and what really is the point of this bris here at Arvos Moav in general? So in source two, I just took a little quote from an article from Rav Gigi from the Gush, who, this was an article in one of their publications where he was talking about Arevid, the whole call yourself Arevid and Zebazay, that we're all interconnected on a personal level and communal level. And he says, though the Tanayim disagree whether Arevus took effect before the Jews crossed the Jordan or afterwards, many Achronim believe that mutual responsibility already existed when the covenant was made at Sinai. Yes. There's a dispute. There's a Braisa quoted in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, where they ask in the Braisa, what is the point of the dots over these letters in the pasuk? And they tie it in. They say it's this dispute. Did Arevus occur after we crossed the Yarden, or was it already before?
There are
tied
dots in the pasuk. There's dots in this pasuk.
Right, there. Well, it's not on Hashem Elokeinu.
It's on Lanu.
Right, it's on Lanu, Ulevenenu, and there's one dot on I. And here, I'll just read you this.
So I guess that would make sense why they took Arvus for it. So
right, with the emphasis being put there. Here, I'll just read the line here. Lama nakud al Lanu, Ulevenenu, va al Ayan Shiba'ad. So Rabbi Yehuda, the first opinion is that we only receive punishment on the Nistaros after crossing the Yarden. And Rabbi Nechemiah, ki anash al Nistaros la'olam, were we ever punished because of somebody else's hidden sins? No. Bahalo kavar nemar ad olam ele kashem shelo anash al nistaros kach lo anash al onshim shebegaloi ad sheavro yisrael siyardim. This is nothing. There was no kind of collective punishment until passing the crossing the Yarden. So Rav Gibi notes that really there does seem to be. Some level of Arevus that existed from Sinai, from standing at Har Sinai, and he gives the two ways that we could understand this, two ways that this could have played out. Arevus was already in effect at Sinai, but was nullified with the sin of the golden calf. There was therefore a need to renew the covenant in the plains of Moab before entering the land of Israel. So that would obviously answer why are we doing this right now. Option number two is, at Sinai, Erebus had the status of a vow, a neder, that Israel willingly and voluntarily accepted upon themselves based on their understanding of the need for mutual responsibility. Later on, the covenant made at the plains of Moab gave it the force of law that would be binding on future generations. Obviously, assuming that kind of a personal vow obviously won't extend to your children and descendants. But now that it becomes instilled in the Torah itself, it becomes binding. Okay. So obviously, the Ksavah Kabbalah did not quote Rav Kigi, but he provides a little bit of an answer and certainly formulates the question very nicely. What was very surprising to me in the Ksavah Kabbalah, he quotes Magid Masharim, which you may have heard of. It's Rabbi Yosef Karo's, the Shulchan Aruch.
He's not the one that his
Magid. I don't know what Magid is, if that's a Malach or it's a Giloy of Eliyahu, a Navi, or that's way beyond my understanding. But it's an unusual sefer, to say the least. He has this very nice comment. It's a very interesting comment. Here on the parsha, let's just go through it in English for time's sake. There's room to wonder why it was necessary to make the nation take an oath again. They had already sworn obedience to the Torah at Sinai. So essentially the same question. Why are we doing this again? Furthermore, we see that Moshe said, so that you pass into the covenant, La'arucha b'bris, but we don't see any response from the Jewish people, saying this is going to happen, and now we seemingly would expect our stamp of approval, or our acceptance, our signature. If you suggest that ostensibly they did respond and accept the Torah, but the Torah merely conveyed the story in a shortened manner, if so, what is the meaning of the sage's statement that this is a quote-unquote substantial caveat to the obligation to fulfill the Torah? The Gemara in Shabbos calls this a modah rabba l'raisa, meaning the fact that he kafa lehem ahar kagigis was, it means we accepted the Torah under duress, and there's kind of a pisphone pay. There's an opening to argue that it's not really obligatory because you didn't give me a choice.
Right, the Gemara that responded, they accepted it again by.
Right, and now he's gonna throw a wrench into that. Furthermore, the response that they reaccepted the Torah in the days of Ahasuerus is also subject to the same caveat, since the Jews were on the verge of being wiped out. So it's, we reaccepted it because otherwise it was that or genocide. You know, we're gonna get killed. So it's the same difference. You didn't solve the problem. Additionally, how can it be said that they only accepted the Torah at Sinai due to duress of having the mountain held over them? Do we not see clearly that they accepted it in goodwill when stating that Naaseh v'Nishma? So he said, maybe that's an answer. However, that doesn't work. The resolution is that even though they said Naaseh v'Nishma, even this was under duress, as they were out in the barren wilderness. They didn't have any maps. They didn't know which direction to travel in other than Hashem showing them the way. And they had no source of substance other than the man. Either way, they're stuck. And it's a fascinating argument. I'd never heard it before. It's also interesting too because he's really pulling it just from the Pesukim themselves. The fact that we're out there, it's right there in the Pesukim that it was under duress. This in of itself is equivalent to having a mountain held over their heads. So even if you ignore the Gemara, it's still a problem. Therefore, now at the end of the 40 years, Israel has the ability to choose of their own volition. Moshe wanted to repeat the covenant, since one might think that the first acceptance at Sinai was conditional, based on what we just said. And this, therefore, is the meaning of the words, lest there should be among you a man or a woman or family or tribe, etc. That is to say that, God forbid to think that such a thing about everyone, but it's impossible to know what each individual is thinking. So he's saying maybe somebody will feel that they want to go do something else, they want to go serve a Avodah Zarah. So let's kind of renew the bris. And now he addresses the problem of the fact that there was no response. Did we actually accept it? They did not respond to him at all, since silence is equivalent to admission / acceptance. It's shtika kohodadam. It's a legal principle found in the Gemara, and he's applying it here, that the fact that we didn't say anything means we agreed with it. Nevertheless, since it's still possible that silence is not equivalent to admission acceptance, meaning that we don't follow that opinion and that silence is not good enough, their acceptance was again only conditional. They accepted it willingly in the time of Achashverosh. Right, but he doesn't answer his initial question on that itself was conditional because of the looming genocide.
I'm questioning if it's possible for it to be not conditional, because it's just on such a large scale. Meaning in an individual relationship, so that things can be conditional or unconditional depending on. But I think once you get to like the large scale of all of Klal Yisrael, even like
I don't know if it's so much the large scale, but are you going to say no to God?
Are you going to say no? Or even like Moshe Rabbeinu, he's been leading you for 40 years, whether or not you like him or not. But we've squashed rebellions. We're at a point where we know he's about to die. He's going through this. You've seen everything that there is to see. Would you dare say no to him at this point?
Right. You saw a whole generation die off because of what they did.
Because what they did.
Right.
You know?
So. Right, and he's speaking to their children at this point. Right, yeah.
Online, if there's a meeting, hopefully one time, everyone.
Right. So maybe this will be kind of the power of the Ksav of Kabbalah's answer, which he starts off by saying these two words, Luli Demistafina. We're not for the fact that I'm afraid to go against everyone else who's been before me. I would say what I'm just going to go ahead and say anyway. It's the same thing as saying, according to my humble opinion, everyone is wrong, and this is what's true.
But it's also he's respecting that there's Masur that comes before him, and he's standing at a certain point, and he's not saying, he's going to tell you what he's going to say.
Right.
He's giving it that caveat, which sometimes is very important. You know?
No, I'm not challenging that it's important. It just gets a little ironic sometimes.
It does get funny. But I feel like without that caveat, you might wonder, especially the time he was living in, people might have, if he didn't make
right.
that caveat, even if he was battling with him, but if he didn't make that caveat when he said certain things, like,
we'll just throw them in with the masculine.
He might have been thrown with the masculine.
Yeah.
Like him and the Malvin, like, it's fascinating because they're known for their, you know, like,
they're very unique,
being
yeah.
very anti-masculine, but both of them are also known for their chidushim.
Yeah. Right, so he said, Luli de Mistafina Haisi Omer, Kimamar Pasuk Ze Hanistaros, Hu Mamar Hamakhela. And then he gives you the Yiddish kar, or choir, which is, it's, I think it's still the same in German. Be Chuvas Yisrael El Moshe. Which, and that, those five words right there are the real crux. This pasuk, it's not Moshe speaking about Nistaros Lanu, it's our response to Moshe. It's Klal Yisrael's response.
It doesn't say.
Right, it doesn't say, V'amru or V'anu or anything like that. It just, it's, first of all, it helps fix the problem. Right, so the conjugation is. Right.
Moshe's been talking of Recha, it's all, you know, and then like here it's Lanu Manenu.
Right,
you know,
so it is a strange shift, and it's also strange that there's no introductory verb there, but the fact that the conjugation shifts is strange, because it is Moshe speaking to us, and then all of a sudden, unless it's him saying on our behalf, and it's because he has to be included in it too, which is also very
reasonable.
Which
is an argument
reasonable.
To make on his point.
Right.
It's an interesting perspective.
Uvze kaimu aleihem v'alzarem achreihem divrei abrisa zos ba'amram.
I like his paraphrase of Yael's Esther. Like, that was like on the pasuk, like, meaning the king, the kibble, like, in the mark.
Right, yeah.
He paraphrased the pasuk there, it's cool.
Which is especially given what we saw from Rabbi Yosef Karo.
He's using that lashon to say that that's what happens here.
So right.
Cool. I like when Mefarshim used like this.
Right. And then he goes in and explains. So he's told us why, you know, essentially why we're doing this or what's happening really. At least through hint. And now he's going to say just what Shem Pasuk is. Nistaros Hashem Elokeinu v'aniglos u'gomer. Mish yavor b'seiser yeh mishpato b'yedei Hashem levado. Hayudei talu moslev. If you do an Aveira in private, it's between you and Hashem in terms of Onesh, in terms of punishment. Ein Adam Yodea Tumanosal Shel Chaveiro, because I don't know what's going on within you. But if it's public, then it goes over to Beis Din, it goes over to the community. To the point where if we don't follow through on that responsibility on our part, then it, the individual sin will fall onto, the responsibility for it rather, will fall onto the community. You say that Shuto is like what we said, it's a lot of, it's everyone.
I don't say this, don't you? I feel like this is the general pshat that's accepted on this person. Somebody else says this, because like, I remember learning that idea.
That it's everyone speaking.
Says, no, the Nistaros are, you know.
Oh yeah, no, no, that's what he's... So I didn't say that. This is Rashi's understanding.
Right.
Yeah. No, so...
He's saying that that's pshat. He's
yeah, his pshat, just in terms of what Niglos v'Nistaros is same as Rashi. Right, because the Ramban says that it's the Nistaros within you. I don't know
what
Avera is.
The Ramban doesn't like Rashi here as Pshat. Right. He doesn't think it's Pshat. So it's interesting. He's going back to Rashi and saying that's Pshat.
Right. But I think what he's saying here, a mikra yotze midei pshuto, is also going on the lanu, that it's everyone speaking. This also, Ba'al Makom Aroi, that it's at the very end of this section, because it's our response to everything that Moshe just said at the beginning of the parsha. La'avrach habavis, and then we say, yeah, we agree.